The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Risen for Faith Festival. My name is Horace Marshall. I'm the Melbourne Director of the City Bible Forum, one of the organisers of the Risen for Faith Festival. The Risen for Faith Festival is a festival of ideas, a place where we continue to ask the big questions raised by the Global Atheist Convention held in Melbourne here on the weekend. We believe that these questions are important and we're thankful to the atheists for putting these questions on the public agenda. And today we're going to examine the question of evidence. Are there reasons for faith? Is there evidence for God? And to help us in this question, we're joined by two highly qualified presenters. Ian Robinson, on the far side there. Ian is President Emeritus of the Rationalist Society of Australia and the immediate past chairman of the Rationalist Society. He has been a tutor in philosophy, editor of numerous periodicals, and a published author. He was also a presenter at the 2010 Global Atheist Convention, and we warmly welcome him today. Please welcome him. Ian Powell, our other presenter, works for the City Bible Forum and is based in Sydney. And he's regarded as one of Australia's leading Christian communicators and has worked as a youth worker, a chaplain to a school, and the senior minister of a large city church. Please welcome Ian Powell. Now, how our discussion today proceeds will, to some extent, be determined by you. You may participate by sending in a question or a comment by SMS on the number provided. I've already had a few comments and questions already, and hopefully we can fit them into our discussion. So as these questions and comments come in, I'll attempt to incorporate these into our discussion so that we can make sure that we're answering the good questions that you have as well. And we're also aware that this is your lunchtime, and we're making sure that we'll all be done by about 20 past one or so to enable you to get back to your desks for an afternoon productive labour. Now, to the question of evidence. All three of us here on stage attended the Global Atheist Convention last weekend. And one of the key things that emerged was the lack of evidence for God. Dan Barker, a former evangelical preacher and now a confirmed atheist, made an offhand comment in his presentation that there was no evidence for God. Now, Ian, it's probably difficult to sort of say Ian or Ian, but I don't know if it's Robbo and Powley, but
everybody calls me Robbo.
Do they? What do they call you, Ian?
The Holy Father.
we'll call him Powley, maybe. So Ian, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but Robbo, how do you answer this, that there is, or how do you respond to this claim that from Denmark, that there is no evidence for God?
Well, obviously, in any complex situation, there's evidence for and against a particular proposition. I think the weight of the evidence is against there being any God. The main evidence for that, well, it's very hard to prove a negative. So really what I'm saying is that the evidence that advanced for the existence of God and for things like the resurrection and so on is not compelling, and on balance, from the point of view of reason, needs to be rejected. So it's really over to Powley to say what he thinks the evidence is, and then I can say whether I think it's holds water or not.
Yeah, okay. Powley?
Yeah, thanks. Ian, whether consciously or not, has used an argument that was first articulated by a man called Professor Anthony Flew, which is that it belongs to the theist. The onus of proof is on us, not on the atheist, to bring convincing proof. Up until Flew put that argument, it was just assumed it went the other way. And many of you will know that Anthony Flew would say that entirely because of the evidence, late in his life, moved from being the outstanding spokesman for atheism, which he was for the last third of the 20th century, to a reluctant believer in the fact that there was a God. Now, he didn't become a Christian, but he came to the belief that an intelligence before the origins of the universe makes more sense. So it's one of the fun things that Anthony Flew, before he changed sides, made life more difficult for us. But I think it's fair to say that we need to show good reason why we believe that a God makes more sense of the universe that we live in than the idea that there's no God. And I think the arguments for God, and particularly the God that I believe in, which is the God, not I believe that there is a creator of some sort, and I believe that creator has made himself known in Jesus. And I would think the arguments lie in the creation, in the making best sense of the world in which we live, the origins of the universe and the origins of life. Clearly, atheism has no answer to either of those, so I'm happy to argue that in a second. And also the difficulty of making any sense of the person of Jesus if there is no God.
So I think so you advanced several sort of reasons, perhaps. So argument from origins, an argument from Jesus. Would that be a fair summary?
Yeah.
So from Robbo, what are your reflections on that?
Well, the very general statement of where the arguments might lie, but there's been no actual arguments presented yet, so it's hard to comment on that.
So you agree with that, Ian?
Yeah, I've only simply said they're the two areas where Christians would argue that there is very strong argument that makes the inference that there is a God much more rationally sustainable than that there isn't. Because none of us saw the creation of the universe. We can't run empirical studies on it. It lies outside the realm of empirical science. So we're all working on the basis. We've got certain things in front of us. We can run certain experiments on one thing. What makes the best sense? We're, in a sense, like forensic scientists. We found a dead body. No one saw the act. How do we best make sense of what's in front of us? And what we found is a live body. So I would think that your basic choices are... I'm not sure whether or not to start with the beginnings of the universe or not, or the beginnings of life. Because I think, as someone who grew up as a, you know, in Australia, and with a great love of science and great respect for science, I had always assumed that science had explained the origins of life. And one of the things that a number of people have worked out, that to argue, for example, that Darwinianism explains the origins of life, is to totally misunderstand and to completely misrepresent Darwin's work. What Darwin's work shows is how you get the multiplicity of a species. Darwin's work assumes the mutatable, self-replicating sort of molecules, which are highly complex. So that to argue that Darwin, the use of the modern use of Darwin, actually explains the origin of life, is to misunderstand or to misrepresent it. All it does is it's a powerful theory that seems to show why there's a multiplicity of species, but it actually doesn't come close to explaining the origins of life at all. And that's the big step. From non-life to life is a huge step compared to amoeba to Ian.
So if I may perhaps even preempt what that Robbo was going to say, but is this a kind of a God of the gaps kind of argument? We appeal to, because we don't know it, therefore God did it. Is that the kind of argument he's proposing?
I don't think it's a God of the gaps. It can be set up like that. I think in the end, whatever line of explanation you have runs into a wall. So certain of my atheist friends, they have to just assume the laws of nature. If you ask them where do the laws of nature come from, they say, that's as far back as we can go.
Where do the laws of nature come from?
Well, about the question of life, it's true what you say about Darwin. He doesn't say anything about the origin of life. What we have is a universe... or an Earth, let's say, 4 billion years ago or so, that with all these gases and so on, and that gradually formed into various masses of molecules and different metals and materials and so on. And then at some stage, some of those molecules, some of those atoms, became living systems that could replicate and could react to the Earth and the context around it, and could even manipulate their environment in some ways. And eventually those things became human beings. Now, it seems to me that there's a gradual continuum there from simplicity to complexity, and at certain stages there were big leaps, and at some stages it went very slowly. But it doesn't seem to me that speculating that perhaps there was a divine intelligence that popped in there at some stage in the sequence and made it that these particular molecules coagulated in such a way as life started to evolve really is a satisfactory explanation. I mean, what I wonder is what God actually did at that point, if God created life, you know, at what point in that continuum from inanimate to animate matter did God actually intervene and swizzle around a few molecules or atoms or something and say, hey presto, it seems to me a very unsatisfactory explanation. Now, I don't know how those atoms and molecules actually went from being inanimate to animate. Nobody does at this stage, and as Ian has said, there's no one there to watch, so no one really knows. People have tried creating life in laboratories with not very much success. They did create amino acids at one stage, but that's about as far as it's got, to my knowledge. So it is a mystery, but science and the scientific imagination loves mysteries. If there were no mysteries, there would be no science. There would be no quest for human knowledge. So mysteries sustain the scientific point of view. They give us problems that are unsolved and give us the motivation to try and solve them. And I don't think the intervention of some sort of divine spark or something at a particular point really helps us to understand where life came from.
So and I think Ian probably knows, I'm not actually suggesting that every now and then God swizzles around, as he said, he does the magician trick. I mean, one of the reasons why...
could you say a miracle?
Perhaps?
Could a miracle be that? Like, yeah, the miracle is perhaps a Jesus?
I think in history there seem to be a very small number of what Christians would regard to be miracles, yes, where God does intervene in his own, directly in his own novel, as it were. But one of the reasons why when Christians, and it was Christians who articulated the scientific method, people like Francis Bacon and Isaac Newton, and they did it on the understanding that there is a rational God who has created a rational species and has given us the invitation to go forth and have dominion. And that can be misunderstood, as I think Dr. Suzuki misunderstands it. But where the invitation for humans to go exploring in the world, they're not messing around in God's realm. So that what we invented, all cultures have magnificent, or most cultures have magnificent technologies, but the scientific method, which is the great powerhouse of science, it's not the individual facts we work out, which are always contestable, but it's the method that is the magic that has led to places like this, in medicine, etc., getting to the moon. That works on what's been called methodological atheism. So Bacon and all these guys, very strong believers in God, but they said, we can go and look at the world and ask, how does it work? And that's really the thing that gave birth to science. Now, it's common in our culture to set up an antithesis between science and the belief in God. That's a nonsense antithesis. And it's provably false at all sorts of levels. But it's not as if Christians, when we set up the discipline of modern science, and I know some people don't like this, but you look at the people who set up the Royal Society in England, which is the premier scientific organisation in England set up a few hundred years ago, the overwhelming profession of those is set up a clergyman. And the notion that there's some antithesis is just a nonsense. It's a debating trick used by some atheists. But no, I don't think God swizzles around at various points. I'm not quite sure how it works. I just think in the end that humans know that when you see complicated things, unless you're taught otherwise, highly complicated things, you have a choice of either accidentalism or design. And I think we sort of know, unless we're sort of indoctrinated otherwise, that when you see highly complicated things, the instinctive response of there's intelligence behind that makes sense. Now, What Richard Dawkins and others say is, it all looks remarkably as if it's been designed, but it hasn't been. Now, he might be right, but I just think, and I think men like Anthony Flew are interesting, who, as they just continued to follow the evidence, in the end thought, no, it makes more sense to believe that behind the origins of life, which Richard Dawkins quite happily admits, when asked specifically, he has no answer. So he actually says it's one of the things he believes without proof. Sounds to me like a religious comment.
So, what's your answer?
I'm not sure if I have an answer. I think that's
so
part
your
of
your answer is the same as Richard Dawkins.
No, I think what I'm saying that in the end, I think that the answer, because I think it answers the one answer answers a number of the larger questions we have, like the origins of the universe, which is a different question to the origins of life. I don't know the exact answer how we got to life. That's why I think science is so wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a tool that we have to explore God's world. They're not somehow or other opposites. But I think I just think that there's a general understanding that I certainly had when I studied evolution in school and other things, that evolution has explained the mystery of the origins of life. It simply hasn't. And I think I wonder sometimes when I listen to the appalling sort of arguments that atheism brings up sometimes, why must they continue to deliberately deceive? I don't think Richard Dawkins is unaware of the fact that he has no answer to the question of the origins of life, because he constantly argues as if he does. And I think it's because in the end they don't have good answers. That's why they have foolish answers, like, for example, the multiverse, to go to the other origins. The whole multiverse scenario is just it's a desperate attempt to avoid uncomfortable realities, but we should leave it for a minute.
Yeah, we'll leave the multiverse. Andrew, what are your responses?
Well, it seems to me that you're in the same boat as Richard Dawkins. You don't know how life started.
No.
People don't know how the universe started. There's lots of speculation and various theories, and maybe in the end one theory will begin to find more confirmation than other theories, but at this stage we don't know how the universe started.
Well, I think we know.
There's a question coming on the SMS, which I think there'll be lots of questions on the SMS. There's no way we're going to get to all of them, I'm afraid. We could, actually, unless we stayed here all afternoon, but I think some of us have to get back to work. So someone's asked a question to you, I think, Pally. Why not just accept that we don't know instead of accepting a good explanation?
To say I don't know, if you don't know, is exactly the right answer. But I think when we're saying, is the universe best understood in its multiple areas, as a universe of which there is no intelligence outside of it, or best understood as a universe where there is an intelligence outside of it that precedes it? And I'm saying, I don't think that because you go from position A to B you've necessarily progressed, but I used to be a happy atheist. I in the end found it an entirely unsatisfactory set of answers to the question of ultimate origins, and think that in the end that there is an external intelligence makes much better sense of the evidence. So I'm trying to be rational at that level, but I'm not pretending it's I think Ian's right to say neither side of the argument at its best is saying we have all the answers to all the questions.
So there's a degree of humility with both positions potentially. So from a rationalist perspective then, Robbo, how do you deal with these unknowables?
We continue researching them, we continue looking into them, and they won't be solved in our lifetime. You know, human beings, but science is, if you look at the 4 billion year history of this planet, we've only been here a very small fraction.
Mm.
We've only started doing scientific investigations for a very small time, so we can't expect to. I mean, one of the wonders, I think, of human life is that human brains have found out so much about the universe in such a short time. But I'd just like to say about Ian, you said, or Pally,
if you say it to me, that's okay.
You made a dichotomy between either its chance or its design, but there's a third alternative, which is a self-organising system, and to an extent evolution is a self-organising system, and maybe life is as well.
Can you explain that more?
Yeah, well, systems that tend towards organisation. So with evolution, it's not chance that drives evolution. It's the environment. Things survive or develop certain characteristics because they're put in position that they're the things that have needed to survive. So it's not a random thing. It's something that occurs in order to have the best chance to ensure the organism has the best chance of survival in a certain context. And sometimes the context changes radically, and you find that the things you thought were going to help you, like being huge and fierce dinosaurs, actually, when an asteroid strikes the Earth, they're useless, and the things that survive are some sort of little mammals that eventually become human beings and other forms of life. So it's not a matter of saying either it was designed by someone, because the whole idea of design begs the question away, because a design is designed by someone. So it's not as if someone did it or it was just random. There are contexts and situations and laws that it all develops within the context of.
So have you developed a false dichotomy then?
No, I don't think so. And I agree entirely. I think one thing that no one is in any doubt about is the idea that life forms survive if they're successful. It's kind of like survival of the fittest is a sort of a self-evident statement on a level. But I think this is one of the things I have found very disappointing about people like Richard Dawkins. I don't want to pick on the guy, but he at times has I don't feel bad at picking on Richard, because Richard's book is picking on people, so I don't feel as if I'm taking some abstract theoretical scientist who's just minding his own business. But he has at times in that book and in interviews I've heard actually defined the evolutionary thing as natural selection, which I can't help but think is just deliberately deceitful, because it's two things. It's mutation and natural selection. And it's the genetic mutation is actually the driving force of it. It's the thing that gives the natural selection a question on what it's going to select, and that is entirely random. And the thing that we know, and we've been doing fruit fly observation now for almost 100 years, because they breed so quickly, so you can see mutation, you can see what would be millions of years of human life, in those settings, that mutations are almost always deadly. And what you need in order to go from the simplest life, an amoeba, to a slightly more complicated thing, is thousands of micromutations all in the same direction. And when mathematicians have done studies on the most optimistic sort of possibilities of helpful mutations, small enough not to destroy the thing, but then that natural selection can play with, you end up with nowhere near enough time in 4, 5, 6, 7 billion years, which is why men like Frederick Hoyle, who's an atheist and is a master of the wild theory, but writes a book about evolution from space. Because in the end, there's just not enough time, even if you're an atheist, there's nowhere near enough time for the billions of micromutations to take you from an amoeba to a rat, even. So that's why they've got to say, well, maybe it's come from... And it's not just that crazy, because Francis Crick, also an atheist, who is the guy who worked out the basic structure of DNA, he has a similar thing, the idea, because there's just not enough time. So I'm saying the theory, the alleged theory that I was brought up on that explains everything, simply doesn't.
But that's not an explanation that brings in God. That's an explanation. I mean, Fred Hoyle says it was spores from outer space. I don't know what he says.
And I think all I'm saying is that the theory, that there are two basic theories. One is that the theory that most humans have believed, and many of our greatest scientists still believe, which is that the universe is best explained as a result of a creative act of an intelligent being, or it's an accident and there's no God. And the defence of that has been, God's a useless hypothesis, a failed hypothesis. We don't need it. Science has replaced it. And I'm simply saying science doesn't replace it yet, and it seems to have no likelihood. And if you go from that to the origin of the universe, which we touched on briefly, I mean, there's...
Maybe we can move back to something that you touched on before, and I think there's a couple of questions that relate to this topic. To you now, Robert, just about the rationality of science. So I think Ian alluded to the point that we can trust in science because we believe there's a kind of lawgiver who creates a rational universe. Can you explain a little bit more about how atheists can trust the universe is rational?
It's an inductive judgment that this looks like the future is going to be like the past. You know, that causal connections have always worked in the past, and we have to assume that they're always going to work in the future, but we don't know. I mean, there may at some point in time, maybe 2012 in the Mayan calendar that runs out, there may be a total change in all the laws of nature. We don't know that because we can't predict the future. But for the moment, they're the ones that worked, and they're the ones that we work with.
I suppose just on the end of the world, we are planning another lunchtime forum, Will the World End, in November this year, talking about that very topic, so you can stay tuned for that. But we're hoping it won't, because I've got to organise my Christmas plans. But just maybe we can just change tack again. There's been a number of questions again about this, and it's something that Ian alluded to start with. I just want to make sure that we have some decent time to talk about this in our remaining 15 minutes or so. You mentioned something about the resurrection or the evidence from Jesus. Now, this perhaps may be more akin to an argument, would you say? Or would that be fair, Robert, that if he talks about, if Ian presents something on the resurrection, could that be perhaps evidence for a God?
To me, there's no evidence, plausible evidence for the resurrection. There's some evidence that somebody called Jesus lived around about the... beginning of the first millennium.
Just a question before we get to, so if there was a resurrection, would that be plausible evidence for a God, would you suggest, do you think? Or
well, it certainly need explanation.
Continue. So you suggest that there isn't enough convincing evidence to...
We've got there was a comic record going around when I was a kid called the Fruity Melodrama, and somebody's unjustly accused of stealing something, and they say, I'm innocent, and somebody says, there you are, she's innocent, she admits it herself. And the whole idea of admitting you're innocent, you know, and the whole, it seems to me that most of the New Testament is people who are saying, oh, you know, I'm innocent, I admit it myself, you know, this happened, I believe it, this is me, but it really has no evidential weight, or very little evidential weight at all, because it's the gospel, it's just the name gospel, good news. It's obviously a track to try and get people to believe in what you're saying. It's not somebody who sit down and say, well, let's look at these events objectively and see what actually happened. They said, they already believed that Jesus was God and was resurrected, and they said, let's write down what we can that's going to convey this story that we think is terrific. So it's not really trustworthy in that sense. It's there's no eyewitness accounts. It's all written 30, 40, 50 years after the death of Christ. It's based on oral stories that were circulated around. Anybody's played Chinese whisper games and those sorts of things knows that oral storytelling is not to be trusted. People, even if they're trying to be accurate, aren't. They tend to paraphrase and pricey and single out specific points. But if there's no actual attempt, but people are just in the job of making up stories and telling stories to one another, there's a huge amount of evidence that people always elaborate, they always change the stories, they always pick out the best factors, they try and make them more immediate. So instead of, you know, we all know this, we hear a story, it sounds good, when we tell it to our friend we say, oh, my brother did such and such, or a friend of my sister's did such and such. We don't say, I just read it on the internet or something like that, because that immediacy really helps with the storytelling. So the whole idea of storytelling, you know, I think infects the Bible as a credible bit of accurate objective reporting about what actually happened. It's a story. It's a good story in many ways, it's a bad story in others.
So just on that, would you suggest that because there are some apparent discrepancies or contradictions between some of the gospel stories, that would provide an explanation for some of those differences between the gospel stories?
Well, God certainly didn't like contradictions. If you go back to the book of Daniel and the Susanna and the elders, you know, they were convicted because and executed because there were contradictions in their story. I think... The contradictions indicate that there are lots of different stories from going around, and it makes it harder to say, you know, which is the right story. And it seems to me, as Daniel did, he didn't say, oh, well, this elder must have been correct and that elder wrong. He said, obviously, in this case where there are contradictions, they're both wrong, you know, and they suffered the last...
So then, Paoli, this starts to make the reason perhaps somewhat weaker with this propaganda written late by people who weren't eyewitnesses. Can you explain kind of? Can you
in 2 minutes
respond?
I feel like the alleged mosquito at the nudist colony. I'm not sure where to start. But Rob has raised a series of very important questions, and all of them are questions that we're familiar with, and frankly questions that I grew up believing, that the Bible is a translation of a translation's translation, there's no evidence for Jesus outside the New Testament, that's all this sort of stuff. I think a lot of those, I don't know where those stories come from, but they circulate in our culture, and they're just known to be true. And John Dixon, who is regularly asked to lecture at Sydney Uni, Macquarie Uni in the Ancient History Department, has a saying that I think is true. She said, on the whole, the myths are not in the Bible, the myths are about the Bible. And there's a huge level of truth. I'll get to specifics in a second. I was at the Atheist Convention and really enjoyed it. And at the lunch in the morning tea in the afternoon, the number of the atheists I spoke to who came up with pure internet slush about Jesus and history. That was perhaps the most shocking thing to me. It's not the speeches, but the amount of utter nonsense that was believed by intelligent people. Just to pick on one or two of the things. Are there eyewitness accounts? Yes. Let me just get this. Two contrasting gospels, and I think you can get a copy of either of them outside. Luke's gospel will tell you he's not an eyewitness. He'll actually tell you he spoke to the eyewitnesses. There's an integrity about that that ancient historians admire. If he was just a liar, a storyteller, he would have said, I saw it. He doesn't. He's quite clear, I didn't see it. John's gospel, on the other hand, keeps telling us, or at the beginning and the end, he's an eyewitness. It used to be laughed at in the 19th and 18th century. But as 20th century has moved forward with archaeology and better scholarship, there's an overwhelming sense amongst most professional historians ancient historians, that John is the mark of an eyewitness. Full of silly details, full of things that are not necessary, just statements like you talk about Jesus going from one town to another, and we'll just use an unnecessary little word like Jesus was going down from Capernaum to Nazareth. Now, it's not the normal word for going from A to B, but if you travel from that town to that town, you'll discover it's a long downhill run. It's just a sort of, he'll allude to things that were only discovered in the last 40 years in Jerusalem, like the Pool of Bethsaida and other things like that, that scholars in the 19th century laughed at John, said this is a nonsense. So I think we actually do have eyewitness work. And one last comment, and so someone else can have a speak, is that are they the writings of people persuaded? Absolutely. I mean, you'd only expect someone who believes, for example, that in the Big Bang Theory, if you wanted the book arguing for the case for the Big Bang Theory, you're not going to say, oh, you believe in the Big Bang Theory, we don't want to hear you, we want to hear someone else. I mean, what you want to say is, no, what persuaded you that this was true? So I could hear the evidence. And John particularly says that he wrote these things down so people could make an informed decision. And what they don't do is improve the story. Because one of the things that historians are massively impressed with is that when the early Christians speak about the resurrection of Jesus, the pattern that they keep saying is, you killed him, God raised him, we saw him. Because what they're constantly saying is that we are actually eyewitnesses. But when they go to write the story down, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, one of the few things that they're all in complete harmony on is the first and key witnesses were women. Now, I don't believe this. I'm a product of the 20th and 21st century. But we know what the first century in Israel thought about women witnesses in a legal case. They can't be any. Josephus will say that women are not to bear witness because of the weakness and the temerity of their sex. I don't know what temerity means, but I don't think it's positive.
So maybe we should get a response.
Worth noting that when the Christians write down the thing, they actually choose the sort of 21st century equivalent of having politicians and second-hand car salesmen as your key witnesses. Why? Because that's what happened. And they are actually honest accounts that are worth at least one adult read, I think.
So, Robert, you responded to him because he's claiming to you that you mentioned that there were no eyewitness accounts. Ian, this Ian over here has suggested that there were and the women were there. Your reflections on that?
Look, the last 15 years I taught storytelling, creative writing, and all of those sorts of things are part of the trade of the storyteller. So it's much more interesting, if you want to write a story, to bring in somebody unexpected. And you say, oh yes, well, it wasn't the men who saw it, it was the women. That doesn't prove that this is true, it just proves it's good storytelling, because it gives you an unexpected twist on it. Yeah, I'll just mention he first wrote stuff on this in the 30s, but a guy called Lord Raglan, who's a folklorist, wrote a book called The Hero. And he analysed the 22 features of hero myths across various cultures, South American, Middle East, Chinese, English, European, Norse, etc., etc. I won't go through all of them, the whole 22, but there are things like the mother was a virgin, there was an unusual conception, the hero is reputed to be the son of God, it's attempted to kill him, there's no details of the child, when he goes to a future kingdom, he prescribes laws, he meets with a mysterious death off on the top of a hill, and the body is not buried, and he has one or more holy sepulchres. They're just some examples of that. He goes through the various hero stories, and people like Oedipus score on the whole 22, Romulus, who founded Rome, on 18, Hercules is 17, Zeus is only 15, Siegfried, the Norse hero, is 11. Somebody, a guy called Alan Dundas, did a survey of Jesus, and you'll know from the list I just read out, there's lots of similarities there. In fact, Jesus scores 17 hits on the hero thing. So, and we know that all the other hero stories were made up. They were made up stories. And that, to me, is very indicative. Here's somebody writing another hero story, and they've got most of the factors that make a good hero story are in there. So it would certainly be something that would make you examine any other evidence that this was a real event and not an example of mythopoesis, myth-making, in this case.
We're just about out of time, but Ian... Two things to those things.
Campbell's another guy who writes like this. They have... It's best, I think, often to go and talk to, read professional historians rather than people who write books at the popular level. Certainly the ancient historians I know, this is just internet nonsense and popular fiction. It starts normally with a general view of Jesus and then runs around trying to find parallels. There are all sorts of... I was brought up on this sort of stuff... all sorts of Mithras cults and all these sorts of... So the trouble is when you actually read the Egyptian myths for themselves, they're nothing like the Jesus story. The weird thing about the Jesus thing, unlike all these things, no one believes that any of these guys are real people. What we know about Jesus, he's a real man. We can know quite a lot about him from writings not in the New Testament at all. You can get about quite a few of the outlines of his life and the Jewish writings from the time. But it's the fact that he really died. This is a man of history. He really died. The tomb is really empty on the Sunday. And there's a small bunch of people who are saying, we saw him. And many historians have come and when they've looked at the evidence, rather than just playing with Western-based mythology, mythologizing, find it convincing. Pinchas Lapides is a name looking at, an Orthodox Jewish historian, no great fan of the church. A lot of his work is on how the church let the Jews down in the Second World War. But he writes a book in the 80s called The Resurrection of Jesus, Historian's Perspective. And he shocked the world by saying, as an Orthodox Jewish man, when he looked at the resurrection evidence, rather than just, you know, joking about it from afar, when he actually brought his historian skills to the evidence, shocked the world by saying he is convinced that the resurrection is not an invention of the disciples, but an historical fact. And history is full of people who, when they finally read the evidence and try to work out what did happen, rather than poo-pooing it from a distance, find it troublingly compelling. And I just want to say to people, it would take you half an hour to get the end of those four Gospels and read them and try to work out for yourself what happened. We know the body's missing. We know there's a group of men indelibly chained with a new message who... Yeah, I'll stop.
Okay, well, now, actually, we've just about run out of time, but I just want one final comment in closing from both of you. So, Ian, would you say that this perhaps is your reason for faith?
My reason for faith is because I was reluctantly persuaded that the other alternative didn't make sense. And so I was persuaded about accidentalism versus design, and then particularly I was persuaded about the question of the resurrection of Jesus. And when I looked at the evidence, evidence is unconvincing if you look at it. When I looked at it, I was very reluctantly persuaded it was true. Was quite cranky about having to become a Christian because I didn't want to become a Christian. I've subsequently defined it's a lot of fun. It's very hard as well. But I'm delighted to say it's not just going to be fun sometime in the sweet by and by. But I think the evidence is persuasive when you look at it.
Robbo, final comments? Ian hasn't persuaded you to look this afternoon.
I'm puzzled by Ian's arguments because he hasn't sort of presented specific arguments, but he's been very keen to find Jews and atheists and so on who support him. And this is a very common thing that happens when people want to create stories and make you believe other people to believe them. They say, "Don't believe me. Look, here's somebody who doesn't agree with me who says I'm wrong." People get up to put forward diets and so on and say, "I didn't believe in any diet, and then I tried this one and it worked." It's a common ploy in actually taking you away from the actual thing that you're considering and actually focusing your attention on that and taking you away to this person over here and that person over here. I urge you all to focus on the actual evidence, not what I say, not what Ian says, not what Professor so-and-so says, not what Andy Flew says, but look at the actual stories and see if you can think on the evidence of somebody telling those stories that are true, or they're more likely to be a group of people very upset by the death of someone they love dearly, getting together and feeling his presence, and that feeling of presence being in their mutual minds becoming the idea that he actually came back, when it's really just in their imaginations.
Well, thank you. What an excellent way to conclude our discussion, but examine the evidence ourselves and see and make up our own mind. Robbo, Howie, Ian and Ian, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. Please thank our
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.